Hello everyone and welcome to this week's edition of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, our Features Director. Charlotte also conducted this week's interview with superyacht owner Andy Scott. Charlotte, what can we look forward to?
Well, he's a great guy, Andy Scott. I really enjoyed talking to him. He's seems quite humble, but very entertaining. He owns the 32-metre sloop Elton, which was designed by Trip Design and has interiors by the famous Donald Starkey. And he also has a smaller 20-metre classic called Telstar. And he seems to be one of the only owners out there who's actually made yachting pay. He charters both of the boats, has refit both of them, and has kept them both on very tight reins. And he's one of those people that seems like a real rescuer as well. You know, in his business world, he lost everything in the financial crash of 2008. And since then, he's built it back up by kind of buying floundering businesses and building them back up to success. And it's a bit the same with the boats. You know, all the boats he's bought, you know, not just these ones, but previous acquisitions, they've always been kind of slightly unloved. One of them had partially sunk, you know, a bit of an underdog, really. And then he's managed to restore them back to glory and get them back on the waves, which is, I'm all in favour of that. Anyway, he nearly got kidnapped by pirates, which is a good story and is exciting. And he got deported home by the government after his narrow escape. So if you want to hear what happened, you'll have to listen a bit longer.
Wow. Full of derring do. That's fantastic. Yeah. I love a good riches to rags to riches story. So that sounds like it's going to be a great lesson. Thank you very much. Before we get into the rest of the podcast, a quick apology for the lack of podcast last week. We did actually record one, I promise you, but we ran into a few technical issues, which meant we couldn't upload it. It frankly was just a disaster start to finish our attempt to record last week's podcast. So it really did feel cursed. So perhaps it was good that we just knocked it on the head, left it for a week, and we return this week.
Yeah, this week things are running a lot more smoothly from my perspective anyway. No more tech issues, no more thumping the keyboard. I've actually just come off quite an interesting call with a lady called Lily Magnusson. She's the co-founder of A Plastic Planet, which is this big organisation set up to try and get us stopping using plastic. But we're actually talking about something different. We were talking about SailGP. And I don't know if this is common knowledge or not, but she was saying how you'll be able to win points in the sport, not just for how fast you can sail, but also for the impact your yacht has on the environment. So A Plastic Planet is getting involved because they're going to be working with the Japanese team and helping to advise them. But I think it's a fascinating concept. I love the idea that you'll be able to do well, not just because of your skills, but because of your sort of eco creds, really.
And you were talking to Lily because we'll be doing a clubhouse event with her about ocean plastics, won't we? So this is part of a week-long series of events we're lining up to kind of scatter around World Oceans Day. We're doing some great Instagram lives with some industry leaders. We'll be doing a clubhouse event, a special podcast. We're releasing kind of a mini film with some figures from the industry. So it's a whole suite of great stuff going on that week. And so this is the clubhouse event you guys were talking about.
Exactly right. So this is happening on the 9th of June. So put it in your diaries if you're listening on the clubhouse app, as Stuart said. And it will sort of be talking about plastics and yachting and how much of a, you know, is it a trivial issue compared to all the stuff that yachting needs to sort out? One of the things she was making point, so she's a yacht owner herself, so she knows this firsthand from every summer when she goes around the Med. And she was sort of saying one of the problems at the moment is there aren't the right systems in place. There isn't the infrastructure. So it doesn't matter if you're using eco water bottles on your boat, you still have to dump your rubbish somewhere in Greece, and you're not necessarily sure it's going to end up in the right place. And she was sort of saying, as an owner, it's very frustrating. There are agents who can help you get everything from caviar to a behind the scenes tour of some amazing amphitheatre somewhere. But when you ask them, okay, can you help with my recycling? You hit a bit of a brick wall. So she was sort of talking about the frustrations with the strides in the yachting industry, but there's just not that network to support it. And there should be some really interesting people in the room who are able to talk from their experiences about what they've found, how they've navigated around this, whose responsibility it is to sort this kind of thing out. So it should be a really, really great debate. And she's keen for it to be quite punchy, which I like as well. So if you want to come to a controversial plastics debate, please do.
I will be there with bells on. That sounds really, really good. So do stay tuned for more information about all the events that are ongoing around that week of World Oceans Day. It should be really enlightening for everyone taking part and listening and tuning in. So we've also been looking at some of the most adventurous super yachts lately. So this was all prompted by we mentioned in the podcast a few weeks ago, we've got a new hire in the office, a new business editor. So he's been kind of fiddling around with all the stats in our Boat Pro Market Intelligence platform, which you can use to kind of measure, you know, see where super yachts have been and measure super yacht activity. So what he's done, he's dug down into all the stats from 2020, and he's figured out which were the most adventurous super yachts in the entire of 2020. So obviously 2020, a bit like last week's podcast, was a kind of a cursed year for super yacht travel. Many owners just couldn't get to the boats, and if they could get to the boats, they couldn't necessarily go anywhere. But some super yachts did manage to slip the net. And as a global fleet, this is reflected in the fact that 4 million fewer nautical miles were travelled by the super yacht fleet in 2020, as can be expected. But some, like I said, some super yachts did manage to get out there. And the winner, the most adventurous super yacht by our measurements, was Anna, the newish 110-metre Fedship. So she managed to rack up a very impressive 29,500 nautical miles in 2020, travelling between the Med and Caribbean, as you'd expect. But she also ventured down to Chile and Argentina and way out into the Pacific to French Polynesia. So well done, Anna, for all that cruising. In second place was the 91.4-metre Explorer Voyager, which was delivered by Swifter Ships in 2019 after a comprehensive 3-year conversion from a supply ship. Voyager managed to travel 27,000 nautical miles last year, visiting South Africa, Madagascar, South America, and she even crossed the Drake Passage to Antarctica. So really living up to her name there. And in third place, a very, very famous boat, Venus, which was famously commissioned by the late Steve Jobs. She did 25,800 nautical miles in 2020, which included two Atlantic crossings, as well as trips to Mexico, Guatemala, Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Galapagos. So there you go. So despite 4 million fewer nautical miles being travelled by super yachts in 2020, there was a few boats who did manage to do some really, really incredible stuff.
It's so great to see these boats really getting used as they're meant to be used. So often when I talk to owners, you have these amazing chats about these incredible boats. And then when you say, how often do you get on it? And the response is always, oh, it's not as often as I like. I managed to get 6 weeks in a year, some in the summer or some before the season. So to actually see a boat, you know, some of those itineraries are massive. To have covered all that ground, they're really, you know, making the most out of them, which is nice.
Yeah, and, you know, hats off to the captains as well, because kind of dodging quarantines and isolation requirements and, you know, border closures, to still do that many miles in a year as dysfunctional as 2020 is pretty impressive. So I'll link, we'll put a link to that story in the description to the podcast. And Nick has subsequently done a kind of 10 most adventurous super yachts so far of 2021. So some more interesting stories and insights there too. So do please go check them out. And talking about more super yacht activity in 2021, the first quarter brokerage stats are in, but I won't spoil the story. Charlotte, kick us off with the first news story this week.
Sure. Well, not surprisingly, the brokerage market is continuing to absolutely smash records. The first quarter of this year saw 133 brokerage sales completed, which is up 46% on the first quarter of last year, which saw 91 transactions. Yeah, a big, big jump. So that's the strongest first quarter on record by some distance. The closest to that has been back in 2018 with 115 sales. So still quite a few more. And brokers are predicting the boom will continue, but some people have raised concerns about the availability of boats. So I'm not sure whether that'll be a factor or not.
Well, this often happens when there's a peaking brokerage activity. You get brokers, a few rumblings saying, well, you know what, all the good boats have been sold. So the stock of brokerage boats isn't what it, so, you know, kind of how long can the boom continue? Because there's just fewer and fewer good boats out there. But, you know, it's from what I'm seeing, it's showing no signs of slowing down.
Well, the Canberra and Nicholson's boss, Paolo Cassani, is certainly kind of buoyant about it. He said people have become even more committed to invest in yachting as it offers an escape from the pandemic. And he said the economy has also always been strong. Apart from the first few months of the pandemic, 2020 was a fantastic year for the stock exchange. So there was and is money available. A pretty good point there. Meanwhile, Denison Yachting's Bob Denison was equally bullish. He said, "Our industry is still riding the great wave of 2020. Our first quarter numbers set new records for us organisationally across all revenue categories." So looking back at those Q1 figures, the strongest performance was in the 24 to 40 metre market. So lots of kind of smaller boats, which seems to suggest there's a lot of first time buyers kind of coming onto the scene. I think that's what you've heard, isn't it, Stu?
Yeah, that's right. I'm hearing that people who maybe have chartered previously, but their regular charter activity was disrupted either by the pandemic or the boat they wanted not being available or not in the right place or whatever it is. These people have said, well, I don't want my access to a super yacht to be disrupted again, so I'm going to buy one so I know it will be where I want it, when I want it, guaranteed. So that a few brokers have told me stories like that. So I would just like to say welcome to yachting, all you new boat owners. Great to have you on board.
There you go. Welcome personally by Stuart Campbell. It's nothing better. But there's one very big new boat owner, right?
Yeah, that's right. So obviously there's been lots of stories in the press over the last few days about Jeff Bezos, the Amazon founder, who has been linked with the enormous 127-metre sailing yacht project, which is under construction right now at Ocean Co in the Netherlands. So this is kind of the worst-kept secret in super yachting, really. So it's been kind of rumoured for a long time in super yacht circles, but it's for the first time it's been kind of reported by the mainstream press. So what happened was there's a book called Amazon Unbound, I think that's what it's called, an excerpt from which was published by Bloomberg, which kicked off this firestorm of speculation about the boat. And the reporter in the story, in the book, links Bezos directly with the project. So we saw this kind of huge influx of traffic to our website with people trying to figure out more about, I think it's Ocean Co Project Y721, I think I've got that right. But you know, we know the project's in build. We know it's a big sailing boat. We think it's a three-masted schooner, but we actually don't know a huge amount about the project. But we do know, obviously, it will become the world's largest sailing yacht when it is delivered. That's if you don't count, as many don't, the enormous sailing yacht A, which doesn't often do a lot of sailing. So we're expecting the Ocean Co. To be launched next year, which should give us our first glimpse of it. And of course, Ocean Co, no stranger to delivering very big sailing boats. Black Pearl, they obviously have that on their resume, as well as a Kiyo, which they built in collaboration with Vitas. So some experience there building mega projects. I just look forward to finally capturing that first glimpse of it when it rolls out of a shed.
Yeah, can't wait to see what that's going to look like. But it's been quite a good few days on the sailing front. Not quite as big, but there have been a few other sort of new launches. Baltic Yachts have floated the 44.6-metre custom sailing yacht Path, and delivery is expected later this year for that. And the Finnish Yard have also just announced the sale of a 33.5-metre all-carbon sailing yacht. The Baltic 110 was commissioned by a highly experienced family with long-distance world cruising in mind. She will be designed by Malcolm McKeon, and delivery of that is expected in 2023. Elsewhere in Finland, Norta Swan have just sold a Swan 108. Described as a proper blue water yacht, she will be designed by German Frères and Lucio Micheletti, with interiors by Swan's in-house design team working with Misa Poggi. Delivery of the boat is also expected in 2023, so a couple to look out for then. It's just great to see some more sailing yachts in build, especially some more new build sailing yachts.
Couldn't agree more. Right, let's move on to our data story this week. And it's quiz time again, I'm afraid, Charlotte. Do you know how many super yachts there are on the water? How big is the super yacht fleet, basically?
I mean, I think I do, because we recorded this last week. So I'd say somewhere in the region of 11,000, if memory serves.
Way to spoil my surprise. Yeah, there are. So We count 11,488 yachts over 24 meters out there. End to end, they do measure 385,319 meters. The average LOA is 33.5 meters, and the average age is 22.6 years. Now, 84% of the fleet, or 9,652 yachts, are power yachts, and only 16%, 1,799, are sailing yachts. So what I found really interesting when looking at the data was the number of yachts launched throughout the decades, which really shows how the industry has grown in the last, 30 or 40 years, really. So in the 70s, just 477 superyachts were delivered globally. In the 80s, that number increased to 999 superyachts. In the 90s, the pace really started to pick up. There were 1,779 deliveries. In the noughties, and that figure really exploded. In the noughties, superyachting just went absolutely wild. There were 3,676 superyachts delivered in that decade. But in the subsequent decade, between 2010 and the end of 2019, that number dipped to 3,103 superyachts. So down about 500 hulls on the previous decade. So it just goes to show you what a boom decade, really, the noughties were. And then I guess kind of the after effects of the global financial crisis had a chilling effect on the industry with fewer superyachts being delivered. But how are we doing in the 2020s? Well, so far, 444 superyachts have been delivered this decade. So we've already almost put as many superyachts on the water in about 18 months as we did in the entire of the 1970s. So if you look at it in those terms, not bad, really.
So I guess the big question is, who's making all these yachts? Because the Italians always say it's them. People in the Netherlands always say it's them. And they compete to who makes the best boats. Who's actually making the most boats?
Well, no surprises, Italy.
It is Italy.
Hold the top spot. It is Italy. They lead the world in superyacht construction. They have built 4,025 of all superyachts ever delivered. Second is the US, with 1,834 superyachts built since records began. A fair way behind them in third is the UK. Yeah, come on, the UK, with 992 superyachts to its name. The Netherlands is in fourth, Turkey fifth, Taiwan sixth, Germany 7th, France 8th, Canada, which surprised me, is in 9th, and in 10th place is New Zealand. So good to see the UK there clinging to 3rd place, beating out the big boat powerhouses, the Netherlands and Germany. We can't beat them in football, but we have delivered more superyachts than them. So there you have it. Some good pub knowledge for you there, if that ever comes up in a pub quiz, which of course it won't, but there you go.
Maybe the boat pub quiz.
Yeah, maybe. Alrighty, that's it for all the news and data this week. Stay tuned for Charlotte's interview with superyacht owner Andy Scott.
Today I'm joined by British businessman Andy Scott. Andy made his first million at the age of just 26 years old, and today he employs over 500 people across the UK with various businesses turning over around £40 million per year combined. No mean feat in these very uncertain times. More importantly, he's also the owner of the 32-metre sloop Elton, which was designed by Trip Design and has interiors by the famous Donald Starkey. And he also owns a 20-metre classic San Germani Telstar, which he rescued after it's partially sunk. Andy, thanks for joining us. Looking forward to hearing all about it.
Yeah, nice to be here. Ask away.
I thought we'd start off talking about where your love of boats began, because I think for a lot of businessmen like yourself, what I tend to see at least is that the well-worn path is to work super hard, and then when at last you've kind of made your fortune, you start dipping your toe into the yachting world fairly late in life. But I think you've sailed since you were a child, haven't you? It says here that you did your first refit at 14. So it sounds like boats have been in your life for quite a while.
Yeah, from a really early age. Obviously growing up on the south coast on the Solent, the theme park, there's so much to do there. So had dinghies and kind of was really adventurous from a young age. Would pop over to Cowes on a little dinghy without any engine and get rescued by the lifeboats. And that sort of got me into realizing there are some dilapidated old boats out there which I could do up. My first one, my mother's friend, he was old commander in the Navy, and he had I call it a 30-foot racing yacht. It was actually a dinghy. It was called Olympic Flame because it never went out.
Yeah.
I basically sort of took that and did a horrendous refit on it from a very early age.
By yourself?
Yeah, got friends to help me. I think I put wallpaper inside. It had beautiful lines and I strapped a big outboard engine onto the back. So I kind of learned my mistakes when I was very young doing the refit. But it wasn't completely madness. I looked at the price of sort of student accommodation and I looked at the price of marinas and yeah, lived on this boat.
I didn't realise you lived on it.
Yeah, unit. See, I'm 6'4". It had 3 foot headroom. When you invite people back, they say, where do I sit? And they can only lay. So that was very interesting.
I mean, a great chat up line for a uni student, I feel.
Oh, I can't remember that. So long ago. But no, I worked the doors of nightclubs, went to uni and then kind of got the bug for working. Lived on the boat for a year in Ocean Village in Southampton and then realised sort of uni wasn't for me and wanted to go out in the big wild world and earn some money.
So from that first boat when you were 14, did your family have boats and had you kind of yachted as a kid, or was it just by virtue of growing up around there and seeing this boat and thinking that looks like a fun project?
No, my mother gets seasick when she looks at a boat. Although she is going, I'm going to get her to do the Atlantic crossing this year on a big one, which would be interesting. I'm not doing it. And my dad was a musician in the Royal Marine Bands, not sailors at all, but I just got the bug very early. I think only child, being at sea, loved being on my own. It was a great experience.
Yeah, so there's that kind of adventure streak in it, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've seen that both your boats are sailing boats. Do you think you'll ever be persuaded to own a big kind of motor gin palace type boat, or is it sailing is in your heart?
No, even sort of when I was younger, I remember sort of sailing quite happily away, sort of not spending any money. I'm tight. I always think of myself as a builder from Portsmouth still. And you see people sort of burning 10, 20 pounds an hour then and thinking that that's strange. And now when I'm in the south of France, I see people burning £1,000 an hour or €1,000 an hour, €2,000 an hour and just still don't get it today.
Yeah, there's a bit of a debate around, you know, is sailing more eco? Some would argue, yes, of course, because you're not burning fuel. Other people would say not so much. Do you view it as a kind of more environmentally conscious choice? Or is it just a financial thing? Or is it the feeling of sailing and kind of going with the wind and that sort of thing?
I think a mixture of all three for me. And particularly, obviously, having mentioned starting young, I had no choice but going sailing. I couldn't afford the fuel. Sort of having developed and having sort of three different large yachts now that have needed crew, probably sounds wrong, but you can get crew that are cheaper, who work on a sail yacht because they do it for the passion. Not cheaper, but they still retain their lives and nicer people. And I think it's just a different experience for everyone involved in sailing, from the crew, the owners, to the guests. I'd say a nicer type of people, but that's the wrong word. A different sort of people, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that the passion factor is something that plays into a lot of people's choices. We had a big classic sailboat owner called Thomas de Vargas Machuca on the podcast a few weeks ago. And he was sort of saying, you know, he gets lots of staff that leave and then come back years later because they love the boat and they love sailing. The boat is a bit of their heart as well, almost. But do you do a lot of sailing yourself? Are you kind of a guest on the boat, or do you get properly stuck in?
No, not at all. And again, that's when I find crew. I said, don't wait on me. I don't need to be cooked for. I can park the boat probably better than you, but I also won't annoy them because they've got a job to do. So you don't want a really annoying owner sort of barking orders. I'm super chilled and just help out. I do night watches and just muck in, really. And again, that adds the dynamic of the crew. They've always become lifelong friends, which is really nice.
That's lovely. And how do you use your boats typically? Is it kind of a day out with friends or longer trips? What's your kind of ideal day on board?
Well, I think the downside of what I've done is I always take on projects, so I never get to bloody use the things. That's the problem I've had, because they're always sort of 80% finished, 90% finished, trying to get them ready for a charter season. So they're very much labour of love. And especially kind of when I had my bad times in business, you sort of have to almost stop work and then pick them up again. I think for me, they're planning long term to enjoy them when they're finished.
And I know that you charter both boats at the moment. Do you think you're one of those owners who's always going to charter whatever you have because it makes sense financially? Or can you see yourself in a position where you have a fleet of charter boats and then you have a boat just for you?
No, I always look at the numbers in all of the businesses, and these boats are businesses for me. And I look at kind of if I can get 6 weeks on them and get 100, 120 grand in of income, they'll pay for themselves. And that's always the anything more than paying for themselves, a bonus. Up until now, I've always managed to do it, which is great, which not many owners do.
I think loads of owners set out with that idea. They're like, oh, I'll charter it and, you know, actually I'll be making money, and then it just doesn't happen quite like that. So how do you think you've managed to kind of run a tight ship?
Just coming back to mentality, really. I still love doing houses up. I do my own stuff. Boat yards and shipyards, we always find yards where you can do your own work. You're not governed by being robbed by the shipyards, especially in Italy and south of France. They're extortionate. The only way you can do it is to be hands-on and doing a lot of stuff yourself and really keep an eye on it.
That sounds great. Well, before we go into actually all about your boats, which I'm really interested to learn about, just talking about you a bit and your kind of personality and your background. You said your dad was a musician, so I take it he also wasn't a big businessman. You know, were there other business people in your family, or are you a bit of a kind of black sheep in terms of what the rest of you have all done? And
sort of grew up as an only child, single mother. So I think you kind of have that survivor mode from a very early age. I grew up around sort of very interesting guys who are like market traders. So I always loved that wheeler dealer, buy, sell. And today I always have that market trader sort of mentality, really. And I think that served me well. And I think however well you're doing, and it's probably wrong, and I know this isn't a counselling session and we won't go into that.
No, feel free. It's a safe space, Andy. You can offload. Won't charge you.
Yeah, no matter how well you're doing, I always kind of think I'm starting from nothing and grafting the next deal. And just in that survivor mode, really. I mean, I love boxing still. I get punched 3 times a week by people lots younger than me who like punching fat old men. But yeah, just in that fighter survivor mode, I think that served me well over the years.
And seeing sort of how successful you were, how young, okay, you then run into some difficulties, as lots of people did. But do you think most young people today work hard enough? Do you think you have a kind of exceptional drive, or do you think everyone else should be keeping up with you, essentially?
I was very lucky, kind of grew up in the sort of noughties when we had, and I was doing up properties and having sort of capital appreciation each year. You could buy a house, essentially lose money on it, but make money because the market was going up for 10 years. And I think the younger youngsters today, they don't have that ability to own houses as I did, get mortgaged when I was 18, 19, 20. So I think that's changed. And I think after 2008, people have seen their parents struggle, people my age. And I think they just view things a bit differently now. They're into experiences rather than material things, which is not a bad thing. So I just think that generation has changed and what people want. I think people still work hard, but the aspirations are slightly different.
And so let's talk a bit about your businesses and what you do. So you've mentioned kind of building and property and stuff. Is that what you view as the kind of the core of your business to date, that you've done a lot of property and developments and things like that?
Yeah, main business, house building. I've built over 500 homes now over the last 25 years. I messed up during the credit crunch, and I had a group of hotels and got them repossessed. And kind of from that experience, I saw an opportunity that these businesses that are struggling, they could be sort of picked up and turned around. It's really great for my own failings that now we work with a lot of people who are on the brink of failure or their businesses are failing, so potentially going to be busy later in the year. And we give them a share in the business, and lucky enough to have sort of 10 different companies now that we've saved and turned around in a number of sectors.
And how do you identify, you know, because presumably there are lots of people that come forward for this kind of thing. How do you identify a business that you think you can save and one that is kind of gone too far?
I always say businesses don't fail, people do. There's usually a reason, whether it's too much debt, a situation like a litigation or kind of a separation. So there's usually a reason why those businesses are failing. And if you can kind of pick up the good bits or pick up the guys and bring them into a larger group, a lot of people, me in particular, I'm terrible at detail. A lot of salesmen, they like just to be freed up to go up and sell and do what they're good at. They don't want to be stuck at home doing boring accounting. So if we can take that kind of HR and head office function off them for a bigger business, it just frees them up. And I always say, think pound signs rather than percentages. A lot of guys have thrived having a smaller share in their business, but they've grown it quicker.
You know, you've obviously had some amazing experience. What's the biggest lesson you've learned, or the best piece of advice someone's given you? What would you advise other people kind of starting out their careers in the similar industry?
Yeah, I grew up with this kind of a debt bubble. I'd never seen an economic cycle before in my 20s. So I had kind of credit cards, Ferraris, aeroplanes, and kind of a lot of it was just fueled by debt, like a lot of people at the time. So I think you learn to be, as you get older, you become naturally less risk averse. And just having stuff in reserve, and also having a bit of a mixed portfolio, which we have now. I mean, during this pandemic, one of our most profitable businesses was a sort of chef recruitment business, which is shut for a year, supplying sort of a lot of leading London sites. So whereas that's shut for a year, our transport businesses have been doing really well. So just really a balanced mixed portfolio.
Okay. So now, do you still have a Ferrari, by the way?
I don't know. I've just had a little one. I've got a 3-month-old. I sold a Rolls Royce last month because it was 2-door and sad day, but never mind.
Yeah, not compatible.
No.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about the boats, because that's the most exciting bit. Before we get on to Elton, which looks like such a beautiful yacht, I was quite intrigued by the story of your first boat, which was hijacked by pirates in Somalia. I love this kind of story, so I'd love to know what happened there.
Quite an interesting story about the boat, actually. I was out on a rib one day. That is the only motorboat I have, a rib, in the South Coast. And I saw guys chaining a 70-foot yacht. She's called Whitbread. She's one of the OYC catches, 72-foot, to the jetty. I said, what are you doing? they said, we're clamping it. And I thought, I'd never seen that before. So I went to the marina office and said, what's going on there? And they said, oh, it's quite a sad story. It was a charity that owned it and they ran out of money. So I got in touch with the charity and they took underprivileged kids out and inner city kids out on the water, which was a lovely thing to do, but they just couldn't do it. So I said, well, look, if I carry on your season's sort of bookings of things, I'll take it and pay the marina fees. And I ended up taking this 72-foot yacht for about £15,000-£20,000. It was, but with these big boats, it's not how much you buy them for, it's obviously how much you spend on them. Yeah, that boat, 72 foot, turned into a sail around the world with over 5 years with 10 friends and got already across the Atlantic. And I think we were coming from Sri Lanka to back to Europe. And at the time, 2009, a lot of boats, the rally we were in, the boat in front of us got kidnapped, which is sad because these pirates obviously see British flag vessels. They think a lot of these guys have money when in essence, these guys have sold their homes on these 40, 30, 40 footer boats. So they just don't get the ransoms, but obviously they're very desperate. They don't know that. And we had a lot of women on board. Just we came into India and hearing the news, I just stopped in India and we all got arrested because we didn't have a permit. I parked in front of the Taj Hotel, which I didn't realize had just had a terrorist attack a few weeks before.
Oh God, yeah, it was that time, right? I remember.
So we all got deported. I had a good joke on the plane because you have a badge saying deported and people were at the toilet saying, what are you being deported to? I said, I didn't mean to murder them. I said, I really didn't. People came nowhere near me on the plane. It was an interesting joke. No, we all got deported and I had to get the boat towed back because we really didn't want to face the risk of sort of carrying on and going past Somalia, having others on that rally being sort of kidnapped.
And do you know what happened to them in the end? I don't know if you were in touch with them or...
Yeah, they were actually released in the end. I think some family paid some money to get them released, which was good, but it's just not worth the risk.
Yeah, I've interviewed quite a few kind of security experts and they always say it's, you just need to have a kind of local guide with you all the time for this kind of thing. I think people that know the tensions in the area. Anyway, great story. So let's talk about Elton now. So can you tell me, where did you find her and what were you looking for when you bought her? How did you come to own what is a very beautiful boat?
Yeah, as I said, I had bad times. I had a 38 meter schooner, which during the credit crunch, I had to sort of let go and kind of sell very quickly.
That must have been gutting. Did it feel like that or was it just...
Oh, it was horrible. Yeah. I couldn't afford the marina fees. I couldn't afford a skipper. So I took it to Africa myself. I thought I was just about to run out of fuel and I went in the wrong fishing harbour. I always remember this. I didn't have any charts, but I thought, well, I've got to get this boat to safety in a place called Hammamet. I went in the wrong town and the whole town came out and I remember looking around and all seven fishing boats sort of towed me off to Hammamet. It was very embarrassing. When you're having bad times, I think I got run over by a taxi and broke both my legs in the same year.
God.
It was a really terrible year. So I'd been kind of out of the yacht ownership market for a while. Telstar came along a couple of years ago. And I really didn't want to own a second yacht. But I said to the guy on Elton, he basically had fallen out of love, I think, with it. And he just wanted to get rid of it. He didn't want the crew costs. I just said, well, look, I really don't want a second boat. But here's an offer for it, which I'll put over to you tomorrow if you take. And I was praying he said no.
Would you describe it as a cheeky offer?
Yeah, very cheeky. Yeah. And the broker come back and said he's reluctantly said yes, if you take it. And I was like, bugger. It really was opportunity led. End up taking it and kind of refurbing it over the winter on the south coast in the UK, and the rigging all needed a service.
Had you seen much of it beforehand? Had you done a kind of very thorough recce and everything before putting the offer in?
I'm probably a bit impulsive. No, I looked at it for about a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, said to the agent, yeah, it's lovely, I'll do it at the right money, but I think they want too much for it. So just dismissed it really. And they were like, I think you should really offer on this. So yeah, end up putting the money over the next day without a survey, which probably not very bright. But
when they said yes, did you feel a bit sick? Was there a part of you that...
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, because you're tying yourself into a life of pain and misery and potential bankruptcy again. My view is a boat like this, she's very well set up for charter. She had a very successful charter career under Cinderella 2, her previous name. So it was just for me, just look at it as a business. It was kind of get her recoded, get her out there for 6 weeks a year at sort of 25 to 30,000 euros a week, and she'll pay for herself. And that is the plan.
And have you done much to her? You mentioned, I think, just briefly now, rigging. Have you done much to the interiors? What's kind of changed since you've owned her?
Yeah, she was more just tired, not used for 3 or 4 years. We've done a lot of all the upholstery down below. It's not a big thing, all new artwork, and just the fabrics and the cushions just modernizing. And generally she just needed a lot of maintenance. We've got a great crew on her now, a couple team who always love couples, because you know they generally stay with you for a while and it's a good gig for them.
And had you looked at many others before you came to buy her? Were there any kind of close purchases before that, or it was just a case of you saw her and thought, actually, that could be mine?
No, just because I think a lot of brokers know that I'm not saying I'm the we buy any boat man. Over the years, having had five or six ones where I've just sort of stepped in quickly and bought them, I think people pick up the phone knowing that not many people would just come in and buy it tomorrow. So I think that's where I've done well on boats, really.
So where is she at the moment and where are you planning for her to go?
She's in Valencia at the moment. We've got first couple of charters booked for Italy for the summer, which is great. She's just been coded and put on the Malta flag. And then the plans to take her to Caribbean for November, Antigua Boat Show, and then potentially head up to Miami. Got an inquiry for Cuba, which I think would be interesting, and I'd love to see myself in March. So Caribbean season, then later in the season, up to Cuba and Miami.
And you mentioned you've just had a little one. So how much are you planning to get on board realistically?
Yeah, baby Elton was born 4 months ago, and obviously I've named the boat after him. It's not ideal to call him a him.
Congratulations.
Thanks. I still get confused when I call her him, but anyway, I'll get over that.
Yeah, exactly. How have your kind of chartering inquiries been going lately? Just we know it's a bit of a weird time in that there's a lot of demand, but people also, I guess, particularly in the UK, are not sure where they're going to be able to get to. So what's your kind of feelers for how it's been going so far?
Yeah, I think much similar to the last season. I think this season's going to be really last minute, especially with the restrictions. I think even though people know they potentially can travel, they don't know what's going to be open and when. So I foresee it as very much last minute. I'm seeing a lot of inquiries for kind of 6 and 8 week charters, which is interesting, because people just think probably could buy a boat, but we'll just take it for the season. And I think where a lot of boats aren't busy, you'll see a lot more of that this year.
If someone offered to buy her now, would you be happy to just kind of, you know, say, okay, fine, and I'll go on to another one?
No. Named her him after my son. I think that would be a criminal. So no, I always planned as part of my retirement to have sort of 3 vessels, a classic, which I kept in the south of France, a great mid-level, as I say, 32 meter charter boat, which is just sort of out there 6 weeks in the Med and probably 4 weeks in the Caribbean, and then potentially look at a bigger one I could live on. That was always my plan.
And I know that everyone mentioned that a J class is a particular, you know, ambition of yours, is something I absolutely love as well. Can you see yourself owning one of them in the future, or is that not on the cards?
I love beauty of the J's, and I don't like the upkeep of the J's, and the market for charter for income is quite limited to the classics. So it's very much so as a business, no. As a project, a passion project, probably yes, but you'd have to have a lot deeper pockets than me for a project like that.
Yeah. And what do you love about Elton? If I'm a charterer and I'm thinking, okay, you know, why this boat? What's so great about her? Is there a kind of standout feature or something about her that you think, this is why I love Elton?
Yeah, just for 32 metres, its volume is huge. The 4 ensuite cabins are something you found. I've had a 38 metre before, and it feels like a lot bigger boat than that. Although it's 1992, it was refurbished in 2012, practically rebuilt. So it just feels like it could be a 5-year-old boat, and it's a real head turner. She's really quick. I travelled down from UK to Parma a couple of weeks with 8 friends and a central travel.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that okay?
And it's a commercial vessel and we're all seamen. But we're really surprised. 12 knots with the Bay of Biscay and generally averaging about 11 knots. So really surprised how quick, obviously not having sea trials before buying her, really surprised. So she'll get you around like a racing boat with the comfort of a bigger Turkish ugly gullet or something like that.
And I know that Telstar's smaller, but I know that when you bought her, she's partially sunk. So what happened there? Something must have gone pretty badly wrong, right?
Yeah, I got a call saying, look, there's a dispute between the owner and the, I think it's sunk on its mooring lines, and the owner was suing the marina. The marina said, if you don't pay the marina bills, we're going to burn it next week. So again, it was a bit of a repeat of what happened in 2005 for me. I ended up taking it for the marina fees just to sort of diffuse the situation, because the elderly couple who owned it just wanted rid of it. So it's just been a 3-year labour of love, really. She's had sort of a new paint job in black, which looks stunning in Spain, a new mast, a new engine. The planks have been redone. She's just been coded on Malta. But that boat I very much see as kind of the classic regatta circuit, Monaco, Cannes, Saint-Tropez. And a lot of those guys, because she is eight bunks and 2 crew, those guys don't stay on for the week. So it's more about the sailing and the race, the drinking probably.
Sensing a bit of a theme here in that, you know, with businesses, you're looking for kind of sort of saving businesses that have been struggling. And it seems a bit the same with the boat, you know, people that are boats that are partially sunk and things. Do you like to kind of rescue and restore things, or is that just a coincidence?
Yeah, and I think boating kind of shaped my career in a way, because obviously doing up hands-on boat at a very early age, I thought, well, I can do this with a house, I can do this with a hotel, and I can do this with a business. So yeah, sailing has definitely shaped my career. And obviously coming back to the deal maker and the market trader, obviously if you are rescuing these things, you're buying them very at a good price, so you should always be able to get out if you need to.
And what's your advice? Because lots of owners, I think, go out there with the aim of getting a kind of incredible price for something and come away absolutely rinsed, you know. How do you make sure that you are really getting a good price for something?
For me, it's picking where you do the work. I've had several bad experiences. I think I've been arrested in Barbados impounded in Italy.
Oh, God.
So I've learned the hard way when I was in Barbados. A Trinidad yard, they kind of said, we found another bill for $50,000. I said, what do you mean you found another bill? And they have a policy, no cash, no splash, but they'd already put me in the water. So I said, look, here's my lawyer's details. I'm going off. You're trying to sort of defraud me out of this money. When I got to Barbados, the boat was impounded and they arrested me on Christmas Eve. I always remember I called up my bank manager and said, Mark, I'm in prison. I need you to put $50,000 on my credit card so I can be released. And he said, bugger off, Andy. And he just put the phone down. He thought I was joking, but I had to call him back. I said, no, really, can you up my credit card limit? And he's like, you're being serious, aren't you? So yeah, I guess I've learned the hard way from just sort of letting yards crack on without kind of a clear schedule. And now it's just finding yards that you can project managing yourself, which are very few. And I understand why the yards want control and they want to put margin on everything themselves and trying to get that extra pound of flesh out of owners. But if you are looking at it as a business, that doesn't work. I'm potentially looking at options to get a kind of boat yard or space a boat yard to do it myself. Our main business is logistics. So if you can do these boats yourself, then obviously you just cut out that middleman, which is the huge expense.
Well, it seems like a good place to leave it. That's fascinating. I hope you will let us know how this goes. If you do launch your own yard, obviously you know where to and out.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Thank you so much, Andy. It's fascinating to chat to you.
No problem. Cheers. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Ed Cavendish and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.